Alright folks, welcome to the third episode of our podcast, The 1001 Arabian Nights. I'm your host, Oban Arekabi.
And I'm your host, Houston Rifai.
And today we're going to be talking about the greatest, one of the best countries ever that you guys have ever heard of, or probably never heard of.
Yemen. Yemen.
Yeah.
Which kind of just means right in Arabic.
Al-Yameen.
Al-Yameen. It means like right hand in Arabic, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Well, Al-Yameen, yeah.
Yeah, if you say go Al-Yameen, it means like go right-handed, right?
Yeah, but I didn't know that Yemen was actually...
It refers to right. No, it refers to like the south. Because if you're like sitting in like the Hejaz, like if you're in like Mecca, for example, one side is... what's the word left again? I always forget.
Yasar.
Yasar? Wait, yeah. No, that's not the left.
That's the left. Yeah, Yasar.
I think Fusa is different.
Okay, what are you going to say?
It was like Shammar or something.
Ah, Shimal. Shimal.
Shimal, okay.
Yeah.
So one side is Shimal and the other side is Yamin.
Yeah.
Anyways.
True.
This is a tangent. Let's just ignore what we just said and say it's a tangent.
It's okay, man. But today, it still doesn't take away from the subject. Yemen. Now, Yemen has a special place in our hearts, man.
Yeah.
Although kind of put to the backside these days, right?
Yeah,
it's kind of a backstory.
It is considered something of a backstory, even though what's going on over there today is among the most horrifying things happening in the world today.
It is, man.
I think we're safe in saying that. There's basically a blockade on like half the country where... the Saudis decided that since they couldn't win, they decided to try to starve everyone out.
It's honestly horrible. I think it's somewhere along what, like 1.3 million people or something like that are starving to death right now. And it's sad, especially given that Yemen in Arabian culture is viewed as their origins.
It's the origin point. And the reason why is because like it has been a place of civilization for so long. And like when people think of civilizations in the Middle East, they think of Egypt, they think of like Mesopotamia. If they think of like anything else, they might think Phoenicia or biblical Israel or something like that. But they don't think of Yemen, even though it was as important to that world as anywhere else.
In fact, Yemen at that point in time was so powerful, it was considered a regional superpower.
Yeah.
You had the Romans, you had the Persians, then you had the Ethiopians, and then you had the Yemenis.
Yeah. And the reason why is because both the... at the time, they'd be called, like, I think Aksumites. The Ethiopians would be called, like, Aksum or something like that. And, like, ancient Egyptians called them... What we think what they called them was Punt or something like that.
Oh, yeah?
Not clear. But regardless, the trade routes that existed there are as old as Nefertiti. As old as the pharaohs of Egypt. For thousands and thousands of years, people have been sending boats up and down the Red Sea trading. And Yemen has been like one of the most important spots there.
Because it's kind of like the middle point. Because at that time, what people used to do, they used to trade... to India,
yeah,
right.
Like
so Rome, so we go from Rome to the Aksumites, then to the Yemenites, and then to India, and then and back, because they couldn't go through Persia, because the Romans were kind of
fighting the Persians,
and so they couldn't go by there.
Yeah, exactly. And plus, the sea routes are kind of the quickest way to get there, and we'll get more into that later. But it's all to say that this sea route that we're describing still exists today. Like when the Somali pirates, like this was a huge thing a couple of years ago, they kind of got a handle on the situation. But when the Somali pirates were like boarding ships and stuff, it was off this coast. It was next to Yemen. And that's because a huge percentage of the world's traffic runs through the Red Sea up to the Suez Canal and into the Mediterranean. this is like the central artery of world trade between Europe and the East.
Yeah, well, 100%. And Yemen was kind of playing like a central point into that. It was really like the focal point. Although, at some point, it wasn't really like that for the Yemenis. Because one thing that the Yemenis were known for, they were known for the incense trade, right?
Yes,
they were
known
for the incense trade for...
So what the Yemenis would export would be like the incense and stuff, and then they import all the stuff that was coming in from like Egypt or India and all the rest of it. So it became like this really great trade hub. And even though the trade routes are still there, nobody stops off in Yemen. They don't get any of the like wealth that comes from owning this massive trade route. Like if they had some control, the port of Aden would be like Singapore, you know?
Yeah, but you're talking about right now.
Right now, yeah.
Yeah.
Because like today it's the poorest Arab country.
Just, it is, yeah.
Despite and... all the shit that happened to Iraq, all of the stuff that happened to Syria, all of it.
Yemen
is the poorest.
It is the poorest, and it shouldn't be like that, because honestly, like, if you guys read about ancient Yemen, you'd be thinking, God damn, man, why don't they just go back to that time when they were honestly like one of the richest civilizations in the area.
Exactly.
You know,
like I think we've
circumstances.
We posted something on the Facebook page to like sort of gin up some interest for the episode, and one of the things that we introed with is like, this place was known as this to the Romans, this to the Persians. They were known in biblical times as Sheba,
yeah.
Saba, which is one of the names of the kingdoms in Yemen. And that is still part of biblical history. The Queen of Sheba is still like this huge figure, you know? And yeah.
I mean, look, Yemen was so, it was so rich in civilization and in wealth that the Romans absolutely wanted Yemen as an ally or with them. So either because they kind of wanted like that rich state to be their friend, and they were going to do that either by force, or they were going to do that by, by bribing them, by trying to bring them closer to their side, right? Because Yemen was that that power hub. It was a home of wealth.
Exactly. Like, when did this like relationship start with the Romans, would you say?
Look, it's kind of hard to say, but to understand Yemen, you kind of have to divide it into like four groups.
Okay.
At that time in Yemen, there were...
what time are we talking about?
Right now, we're talking about like the first millennium BC, you know?
Okay, so like pre...
Yeah,
pre-Roman. Okay.
Yeah, so there were four groups. You had the Sabians, you had the Minians, you had the Qatabanians, and then you also had, if I remember this correctly, you also had the, it was Minians. It was, and the Hadramites, right?
Okay.
And basically all four of them, because here's the thing about Yemen. Yemen is, geographically speaking, it's a lot of mountains, right?
Okay, yeah, and but so, the mountains bring rain and fertility and all the rest of it, right?
Yeah, but also what mountains do is that they're natural borders. They create divisions.
Okay.
So you never actually had one empire that kind of spanned all of Yemen. You always had like four or five or whatever groups.
Like around like a main valley. And
exactly.
Then, and then they fight over like border. It's kind of like Greece, ancient Greece a little bit. Like,
a little bit, yeah, but because the terrain was like that, right?
Yeah.
And so one thing that the Yemenis were known for was incense. And
frankincense.
Frankincense, right? So perfumes, odors, right?
Yeah.
All that good stuff. If you want to look good, if you want to smell good for a date, well, you just have to go up to some Yemeni and tell him, hey, man, I got a date tonight. You think you can hook me up?
The Romans had a pretty good dating culture. I guess they were like, ooh, this came from all the way across the sea in Yemen. Ooh.
Oh, yeah. It was that exotic place.
Oh, yeah.
And so those who were... the most specialized in the trade were the Minians.
Oh.
Okay, they were the ones who were most specialized with it. They weren't the strongest though, because the Minians, the one thing that's about them is that they didn't really concentrate their resources on war. They didn't really think about doing military expansions like the Sabians. The Sabians were the most powerful group, right?
I think they dominated at one point. We'll get to that.
They did dominate, yeah. Actually, yeah. They were dominating at that time. Okay. They were dominating at that time, and they dominated for a really long time, right? The Minions are the ones who were mostly selling, you know, incense and frankincense. And at that time, what they were doing, they were selling it through caravans, going, right, passing by the desert along the coast of the Red Sea.
Oh, so the Hejaz. So yeah. Like, so what we think of this as like the major trade route, but there'd be like two ways of doing it, right? So like you could go on a ship to the ports and stuff, or you could send it up a trade caravan up to, I guess, like what at the time would be Petra.
Exactly.
And then sell it to the Romans there.
Yeah, and that's basically what was going on. It's kind of the modern day equivalent to loading your stuff up on trucks and then just going up.
We still use trucks, even though we do have ships, you know.
It's the same idea at that time, because at that time ships were not that, like, they didn't develop that yet. Like, it was still around, but it wasn't that big. And you know, the Minyans were so good at that trade. Like, it is said that they had somewhere around 3,000 families, Minyan families, that kind of they monopolized trade.
So they it was sort of like a cartel. So like,
a little bit, yeah.
The Minyans were the cartel, and they would like pay taxes to the Sabaean king, I guess.
No, not really, because the other ones were also participating in that trade. I mean, that's how they made their money. But the Minyans were just really, really good at it. In fact, whenever Minyans would work on their trade, it was kind of sacred work, right? It was seen as sacred because they were so good at it. They considered that as like something sacred. Like, you know, I'm doing my craft, right?
Oh, okay.
And so to the point where, like, if somebody was working on that, harvesting whatever it is needed to make perfumes, he wasn't allowed to interact with women, nor was he allowed to go during funeral processions.
What?
At all. Yeah.
So it was just like, I guess it became such a part of the culture that like it became like the like main, I guess like businessmen today could be a little bit too work focused, but then they go, you know, to some agency that does all the weird stuff for them.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, and when, it was kind of the same idea a little bit. Like, these guys, I don't know, these guys were really like focused in their craft so much that, hey, I can't talk to women, I can't do anything right now. This is what I got to do.
All right. So that's the Minyans. Well, what are the Hadramites? Who are they?
Hadramites are there are people who live on, I would say it's roughly the eastern side, the southeastern side a little bit.
Okay.
Not much is known about them.
Okay.
To be honest, not much is known about them. They didn't play that significant of a role in Yemeni history.
We just need to know they're a thing.
Yeah, they're just a thing, right? And then you had the Qatabanis, who played a role. They were kind of in
which region are we talking?
Well, not right now. We're talking about east, but we're talking about north. So above the Hadramites, so northeast a little bit.
Okay, so northeast, and the Sabaeans would be the north.
Exactly, they would be somewhere in the northwest.
The northwest, and the Minyans are which part of Yemen?
Somewhere in the central area, like close, like.
Where Taiz is today?
A little bit, yeah, okay. A little bit.
Okay.
And so, roughly speaking, and the Sabaeans were obviously the stronger ones, right? They were the ones dominating.
Okay.
The Qatabanis, they were the ones who were, if I'm not mistaken, they were the ones who were kind of in a clash with the Minyans, with the Sabaeans a little bit.
Okay, so they were the rebellious ones.
Yeah.
So with that, all that said, like, why were the Sabaeans so dominant over all of this?
Military power, man. That's really what it goes down to. They were honestly just because of they kept going on to like military expeditions and then just taking over land. I mean, the Sabaean kingdom.
So they became synonymous because of that, and that's why foreigners would know the entire region as the land of Saba, the land of Sheba.
And the way they did that is actually, you know, the one of their famous kings, his name is King Karib al-Watar, son of Dhamar Ali. It's old names, man.
Wow.
He led two military campaigns, okay, that defeated nearby kingdoms, right?
Mm-hmm.
So one of so they just attacked villages and kingdoms and just, you know, on taking. And at the same time, they also took like incense routes.
Okay.
So they kind of controlled the trade. So the routes that go from Yemen all the way up the coast of the Red Sea.
And then they can tax the trade.
Exactly. So they kind of...
And then they're rich.
That's how they did it, because they taxed kingdoms and then they taxed the trade.
And what did they use the money for?
They used their monies to build irrigation networks, to fortify their towns, to really just consolidate their grip.
And the thing that the Sabaeans are known for is, like, the reason why they were so powerful is because they had a bigger population.
Yeah.
And the reason they had a bigger population was because they were masters of irrigation. So, like, building these massive irrigation projects.
And one of them is the Ma'rib Dam.
Exactly.
That we spoke about.
Briefly.
It was in the first episode. Yeah.
I think in the very first episode we spoke a little bit about it, but like I can't like overestimate, like we talk about the pyramids as this great wonder of the world, but they just sit there, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Like the pyramids are impressive to look at, but they're kind of just sitting there.
I mean, the pyramids are kind of an ego project.
Exactly. It's one guy's ego project, but like the Ma'rib Dam, this thing created an oasis. It was the biggest one of these projects where they dam up rivers, because the way that Yemen works is the seasons when it's raining and when the snow falls happens, there's a season where everything floods in the valleys and destroys everything, and then there's a season where there's no rain and you can't grow anything. So if you could just regulate the amount of water you get, you could build gardens of immense size and immense value. And that's exactly what they did over and over and over again. And the biggest one of these projects, built almost 3,000 years ago, was the Ma'rib Dam. And this dam is massive. And they actually recently rebuilt it. And by modern standards, it's a smaller irrigation project. But for the ancient times, this it was probably
pretty big at that time. Impressive.
It supported 100,000 people or more in an agricultural region in the northeast of Yemen, and that was like the seat of the Sabaeans' power. And this thing created an oasis, something of the size of the one around Damascus, which is famous for being like this one extremely fertile place in Syria where one of the first agricultural communities in the world existed. And that's the sort of thing that we're talking about here, is that these were great builders. They're sort of like the Romans in that way, great conquerors and great builders.
Yeah, they were. You can kind of say they were the Romans of the Yemenis, right?
Yeah.
Of the Yemens.
But like, how do we know all of this? Like, how do we have so much information about what their societies were like? Because
it was mostly due to Greek and Roman explorers going there, learning about them. Because you know the Roman world was so fascinated about these guys. You know, they absolutely wanted to know everything about them because, you know, they were really rich people. They were really rich, really well off, right?
Yeah.
And they controlled an important part of the trade. You know, mm-hmm. they were right there. They're the middleman between India and Rome. So, I mean, they were really interested about them. And they said some interesting things about them, to be honest.
Okay. Right. I'm seeing in the notes that we had two Greek travelers who went at one point.
Yeah. It was Theophrastus and Eratosthenes. And basically, they were just describing... the four major people. Okay. And they were just talking about, you know, the Minyan families, how 3,000 Minyan families kind of had the monopoly of the incense trade and the musk trade. And he was talking about their...
I don't know if 3,000 families is necessarily a monopoly, but okay.
No, but yeah, like they were the ones who were like specialized in it, you know what I mean? Okay. All
right. And...
yeah, but you know, these guys were sending their caravans to Gaza, to Mesopotamia, to the Levant, to Egypt, to really in the Middle East.
Right.
But at some point, something happened. They stopped sending caravans and they started to use more the sea routes.
And I can kind of inform you as to why. Because I think the shift happened specifically when Augustus took power in Rome.
Okay.
And the reason why is when he took power, he also took over Egypt. And Egypt had long been the linchpin. But the problem is, in order to, like, basically, the only part of Egypt that's fertile is the Nile.
Okay.
That's the only part that's fertile. So the coast of the Red Sea is extremely dry and extremely hot, and it has almost no water sources. So you can't support populations out there. In Yemen you can, but in and in the Hejaz you can, but in the on the western side of the Red Sea, it's almost devoid of major population centers, especially right next to the coast. So you can't really have towns. So what you have to do is build a huge amount of infrastructure, deep, deep wells, and ship in all your food from the Nile River over land to the sea. And that takes a lot of work. And anybody who's trying to do that who's not part of a government or part of a big group is just going to get raided by people out in the desert. Like, they're just going to steal all your shit.
Yeah.
So you have to build like fortifications, roads, all of that in order to make it profitable. And you could have done that, and there was like civilizations in Egypt who could have done that. Like, there was even at some point in the past, like 800 BC or something, there was some pharaoh who was attempting to connect the Nile with the Red Sea, like through a canal. Like, this has been an idea that has existed for a very long time. The Persians tried it out, they failed.
Okay. But,
and nobody, not even the Romans, were able to do it at that point because it's a massive project. But at least to build like these like fortifications and these towns and like supply them and all that, you could do that back then and it would be profitable.
Yeah.
And there's also mining resources out there. But the problem is, for about 300 years, Egypt was ruled by a bunch of incestuous, murderous Greeks called the Ptolemaic dynasty. So the people who bore Cleopatra, all of her family up the line were basically marrying their siblings and then killing them in that order. It was an absolute messed up historical, because Egypt is so rich that anyone who takes control of it should, if they like organize it properly, should be able to fund whatever ambitions they want.
Yeah.
And that's what Augustus did eventually. But, and that's what Cleopatra and Antony tried to do as well, because they were actually competent too. But her ancestors were so incompetent, they couldn't even run that properly. They just kept killing each other. So for 300 years, there was no movement there.
And so
what? And so the trade in the Red Sea just was nothing. It was 30 ships or something. But by the end of Augustus's reign, it had, I think, gone up 10 times. There was like 300 ships a year docking in these major ports. And that's a big change.
And you know what that did? Because there's more ships that were passing by Yemen because of this, the tribes that were living in the highlands, here's the thing, the Yemeni highlands are close to the coastline, right? The Yemeni highlands are very close to the coastlines. And so because of that, seeing those ships passing by, they began to take advantage of that and actually build ports and invest into that. Those tribes that were living near the desert, who were running the caravan, who were trading through caravans, well, they began to lose less. Began to lose influence.
The world's winds shift. The whirlwinds shift the other way, and you no longer have advantages that you used to.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, and so though those people living in the coastline, they started to take over more. They started to gain more influence because they started to build ports and they started take charge of the trade.
But it also makes the trade much bigger, and it also extends the line of trade all the way to India. So like that's where the Romans are getting. It's through this route that the Romans are getting a lot of their silk and their peppers and stuff like. But we're talking about all these like trade, this trade, but what are they actually trading? Like, what were we talking about?
Well, according to your here's research? The thing: the Yemenis imported wheat, wine, copper, tin, Arab clothing. This is something that's interesting. Arab clothing.
Okay.
Coral, storax, and aloe and perfume.
What's aloe?
Aloe. It's kind of like it's this. How do I explain this, man? It's not a
plant. Oh, aloe. Like it's like aloe. It's that plant. No, it's that plant that you use for sunburns.
Sorry, man. I was thinking of the word. What is it? Plant is it?
I mean, that's pretty useful. It's a lot more useful than silk. Yeah.
And perfume, right? Yeah. Here's an interesting part.
Oh, the export perfume.
Yeah, right? That's what they imported.
So like they'd send the raw materials to Rome and then they'd they like get back perfume?
Yeah, or they would manufacture it in Yemen, and then send it back over there into Rome, because that was mainly what their monopoly was. Okay. But when they imported perfume, it must have been some other types that they didn't have, right? Cause just for a variety. That's what my guess is, right?
Okay, interesting. So like we're talking about like so coral also, that's interesting. Yeah. Even though they're right next to the sea.
You know, tin, copper, and Arab clothing. Because here's the thing about Yemen. Interestingly enough, Yemen, even though the Arabs claim that Yemen birthed them, Yemen is not Arab.
At this point, it's not.
It was not Arabic. No, at this point it wasn't. And they weren't speaking Arabic, and they actually had very like contentious relations with the Arabs, right?
Interesting.
Because it wasn't I mean, they didn't see themselves as Arabs, really. They didn't. They saw themselves as whatever they were, either Sabian, Minyans, or Katabani, or Hadramaut, or Himyarit, or whatever.
But these are that's because they're settled people. The Arabs are the people of the desert.
Yeah, because I mean, there's this thing about Arabness and what Arabs are, and everybody agreed at that time that Arabs are the people, are the nomads living in the desert.
Exactly, but the Yemenis, like the it is interesting because like we're getting to these like nomenclatures, but the Romans called Yemen the Arabia Felix.
Yeah, because they were
fertile Arabia.
Exactly, and that's probably because they were speaking an Arabian language.
Or like they were similar enough that
the Yemen, the Romans are mixing them.
Although I'll counterpoint this, one of our pictures that we posted on the Facebook page is of like a king who's in robes and has a gloriously huge mustache. So I'm gonna counter that's the clincher. That's definitely an Arab right there.
It is because like no, here's the thing. Like if you look at one of there was an explorer.
Okay.
Okay. There was a Roman explorer that went there and he spoke about what he saw. Okay. And here's what he said. He said that for some reasons the Arabs, because he said for some reasons the Arabs, they either wore a turban or let their hair long, but they all had mustaches.
Okay.
They all had mustaches. And then, which got me thinking a little bit, I'm like, yo, wait, hold up, man. Even back in, even in Iraq, like in the 70s and 80s, and even before that, and even in Syria, like, everybody wore a mustache. And I just thought it was just a fashion thing, but it turns out, like, it's actually an ancient tradition. It's a typical Arab tradition of having the mustache, you know?
Exactly, which is kind of like the opposite of what a lot of some of the more religious guys do, which is what they'll shave off the mustache.
Yeah.
And then go straight for like the
beard.
The neck beard kind of thing.
Kind of like an Abraham Lincoln look.
Yeah, I don't think it's that great a look. The mustache, no. Even though it gives you like 80s so-called
vibes. It's still
vibes,
class.
It's still good. I mean, that's just because he likes his mustache, but whatever.
Yeah, no, I do rock a nice mustache.
But like, getting back to the idea of identity, like I put this in the notes because I thought it was really interesting. Like, take Mongols, for example.
Okay.
And when you're talking about a nomad, nomads usually have very different understandings of their identity, where they sort of, as long as they have like some sort of blood relations with or like a close contact with somebody, they'll still consider themselves part of that. So today in Mongolia and among the Mongolian people, there's groups who speak a Turkic language,
okay,
but identify as Mongolian, even though they don't speak a Mongolic language. It's just over time, the cultures came together, and also the confederacies that were built included them. So it's more about your alliances and your relationships rather than necessarily your identity, you know?
Yeah.
So like that actually like appeals to a certain understanding of like identity too, because like you can be an American and speak Spanish, you know? Like, it's
no, 100%.
It's more fluid than like just this basic linguistic dominance. Although language is usually a really good measure. This is another way where like nomads are a little bit more fluid in their identity than settled people are. So like the Arabs might have considered themselves like very much related to these Southerners, but the Southerners, the Southern Arabian people,
they didn't see themselves related to the Arabs at all. In fact, they considered them to be savages. But yeah, we'll get to that later on, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
But that's the thing.
It's going to be a theme. So tell me more about this explorer. This sounds like a good story.
Well, all he did, honestly, was that here's the thing, right? Aelis Gallus, if I'm pronouncing his name right.
Aelis Gallus.
Yeah.
Aelis Gallus.
Yeah.
Which kind of implies that he's either from Gaul or his grandpappy was part of the conquest of Gaul or something like that.
He is the general put in charge by Augustus to invade Yemen.
Okay.
Right? And so, because Yemen was so rich, Augustus wanted Yemen to be either like... he wanted Yemen on his side, either as a rich friend or he wanted to subjugate them as a rich enemy, you know? Because
a rich province, yeah.
He absolutely wanted Yemen. And so he sent in Aelis Gallus.
Let's go with that pronunciation. Yeah, okay.
And he was the man in charge for the attempted invasion of Yemen. He couldn't do it, obviously, by himself. He needed help. So he got help from this Nabataean administrator.
Okay.
So he put his trust into the Nabataean man. That Nabataean man was not truthful with Aelis Gallus. He was not truthful with him at all. In fact, he kind of backstabbed him by misguiding him, bringing him to like these places where nobody lived, dragging him through the desert, dragging him through the waters, and just like really just... he was stretching the whole thing.
What is he doing?
I don't know, man. I mean,
you know what he's doing? He's trying to make sure that no more of this shit goes on in the ships. It's more like he's a caravaner, right? From Nabataea,
yeah,
which is like the north of Arabia down to Yemen. So he wants to make sure he keeps his monopoly or something.
Probably. I mean, the guy all I know is that this guy did not want Rome to invade Yemen. So what he did is that, you know, he kind of dragged actually he dragged the trip for so long. The Romans ended up reaching Yemen 2 years after the fact.
Okay, it's a long way, but it's not that far.
It doesn't take you 2 years to go from Petra
up in the north,
up in the north in Jordan to Yemen. That's not a 2 year trip. by no stretch of imagination.
Almost nowhere in the world is that a 2 year trip. Maybe to China back then.
Maybe, right? Yeah, maybe. But even then, like, you gotta walk, right? But this is like... Anyways, man, it just took him 2 years. And so when the Romans got there, they laid siege on like a couple of cities. They invaded, attacked a couple of cities. But then the Roman army got thirsty. Their water supplies were running low, and so they had to retrace their steps, okay?
And go back home.
Yeah. And then
denied water by the locals probably.
Maybe. And this is what he said, right? This is his account. This is Aelis Gallus' account of what he saw. He said that the nomads live on milk and the flesh of wild animals. By the nomads, he's talking about the Arabs, okay? Not the Yemenis, because it's not the same thing. The Arabs. And that the rest of the tribes extract wine out of palm trees, as the natives do in India, and get oil from sesame. And that the Himyarites are the most numerous tribe. The Himyarites, by the way, given because he's mentioning the Himyarites right now, we're talking about...
Later on.
Yeah, later on. We're not talking about 1000 BC.
We're talking about actually around zero, because we're talking about Augustus right now. It's around zero BC.
And that the Minyans have land that is fertile in the palm groves and timber and wealth in flocks. So like we were talking about, the Minyans were extremely rich people because they mostly focused on trade, kind of a little bit like the Phoenicians.
Wealth in flocks of sheep and other, you know.
Yeah, and that the Qatabanians and Agrians, and especially the Hadramites, excel as warriors, and that the Karanians have the most extensive and most fertile agricultural land, and the Sabians are the most wealthy, owing to the fertility of their land and their production of honey and wax. Okay? So he just talked about the different groups of people that he saw.
And gold mines and forests and all the rest of it. Okay, there you go.
And here's what he had to say. He said, the Arabs wear turbans or else grow with their hair unshorn. They shave their beards but wear a mustache. Others, however, leave the beard also unshaven. But for most of them, a mustache.
Actually, that kind of like it makes me think of Sikhs, actually, like with like the Punjabi kind of like the they don't cut their hair, they wear turbans. Like
it's true.
I know it's a stereotype of Arab and turban, but like that's not actually a thing these days. But the back then, I guess it kind of was.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I didn't even make the connection with Sikhs, but you're right.
It kind of like has that same kind of vibe to it.
I mean, look, that area was trading with India, so they probably.
Then again, there's only a certain number of like human ways of like styling yourself, right? So eventually it's going to come together at some point.
It's true. We only got more innovative towards like the 80s.
Exactly.
You know? But yeah, so the Himyarites, you know, they had their capital in Zafar, which is in the north.
Actually,
west.
No, I looked it up. I looked it up before our episode. That one is the modern city. It's right in the valley of Ib, which is in the south central part.
South central part. Okay, sorry about that. And
Sabians would have been more north.
And they made a yes, exactly. Yeah, I just remembered because of Najran, the incident of Najran. But anyways, so the Himyarites, they made a coalition with the Sabians.
Okay.
And the Sabians were not happy about it, but they kind of had to concede to that because even though the Sabians were the strongest at some point, they kind of lost their dominance, and the Himyarites ended up taking over. And the Sabians, they had a little revival like in the second century AD. So for like a century and a half, they were kind of taken over, right? But then their influence just withered down and they died out. So at that point, you only had two groups left in Yemen, the Himyarites and the Hadramites or the Hadramaut. And these guys, remember how I said there's Qataban? If you guys are wondering what happened to Qataban, it just died out. So you had these two groups, the Himyarites.
They got carved up, right?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, well, the carving up ended up happening between the Himyarites and the Hadramaut once the Qataban group kind of died it out.
Okay.
And then the Himyarites just overran the Hadramaut, and there you go. Himyarites became the
first true kingdom.
Let's say, that actually ruled all of Yemen.
Okay.
So, I mean, if you think about it, it took... what, like 1,000 years for Yemen to be one kingdom? Like all of Yemen?
Even though the Sabaeans were like top dog, they didn't really control everything.
No, they didn't at all. I mean, they had a part of it, a big part of it. The Minyans had a part, the Qatabanis had a part, the Hadramauts had a part. But then, you know, politics shift.
And all of these people, like we're saying that they're kind of related people, but they all speak dialects that are so different that we'd probably call them different languages, right?
Yeah, the Sabians they're speaking a Sabaic language, the Himyarites a Himyarit language, the Hadramauts a Hadramaut language,
etc.
Right? And then the Himyarites, they became like the top dogs. Actually, they were ruling all of Yemen under the ruler of King Shammar, who is not related to the Shammar tribe, by the way.
Okay.
Not the same thing. But you know how I said, like, here's the thing about Yemen. You know how I said Yemen, they didn't view themselves with Arabs and they had, like, a contentious relationship with the Arabs?
Right.
I mean, their relationship was not, it wasn't good at all, man.
It's going downhill now?
It is. It's been going downhill and it always has been, especially since when the Himyarites took over. Cities were getting poorer, and the Arabs, you know, the people, the folks living in the desert, they would invade and raid these cities.
Oh, okay.
You know what I mean? They would raid these cities. They were coming in from the north, and they were raiding these cities because they were just, they smell fresh meat, you know? Let's just say that.
But actually, that's really interesting that you mentioned that, because that relationship between, like, the nomads and the people around them has existed like forever.
Yeah.
But like with this sort of like, sometimes it's like literally raiding, sometimes it's like, oh, an extortion racket, and other times it's like actually peaceful. Like it changes.
It changes, yeah. But the politics change.
But I did notice there's like certain towns, like one of the things you notice with like ancient Yemeni cities that are still standing, and there's amazing like
architecture.
I swear to God, Yemen would be one of the biggest tourist destinations in the world if it wasn't for all of the conflict and all the rest of it, because it's one of the most beautiful places I've ever seen in pictures.
It is. I mean, if you guys take a look at the oasis in Yemen, it's just magnificent.
The mountains, just, like the cities are built on side of mountains and they look unique to everything.
Yeah.
Like the old city of Sana'a is like every building is a painting.
It's truly a remarkable place, man. I mean, it's kind of too bad what's happening right now. It's sad.
Well, the reason I bring it up is because there's a couple of these towns, but one of the best examples is like there's this small town of like a couple thousand people, but they built it vertically so that they have stories that are 6-7 feet stories tall. They have buildings that are 7-story tall. And why would you do that? Like you have plenty of land around. It's for defense. From raids. So they built their cities
from the Arabs.
Exactly. So they built their cities in such a way that they had to have small walls that are harder to invade, and it's much harder to attack towns that have like huge buildings than it is to attack and like mud buildings, so you can't burn them down easy, you know. Like these cities are, it's interesting because every civilization creates their own kind of like defensive buildings. Like the Japanese have like these sort of they create hills in order, like they have stages, like layer cakes of castles.
Just so they can slow down, I guess, the enemy.
Exactly. So like they have like one wall that is sloped and it's like a palisade, and then there's the next one. And each civilization kind of comes up with their own ideas of how to build defensive buildings. And this is one of the most unique I've ever seen, where they like build a small wall, but it's really the buildings that are the defense themselves in like every building.
Well, I mean, they kind of had to do that because the Arabs were kind of being relentless on their raids against Yemen. Actually, look, there was even this incident where like in the Yemeni highlands, right? The tribe of Hashid, that's a Yemeni tribe.
Mm-hmm.
They had to make war or wage war against some of the Arabs on the on the borders of the tribe, okay, and they had to wage war inside Arabian land in order to protect in order to protect Saba or the Sheba, because the Arabs just kept on going in, desecrating everything in their path. You know, in fact, like they saw the way they dealt with Arabs, they kind of had like the special policy where, like, if they wanted to make deals with the Arabs, like the only way you can deal with them is, man, we gotta kidnap their kids. We gotta kidnap their kids, and then like force an allegiance with them, you know?
Exactly.
Like,
and that's something you see in almost every culture. Is like that's a sort of. That sort of kidnapping the enemy's children in order to make sure that they like have good behavior. Like the Iranians did it, the Romans did it, everybody did it. And it's a very good way to do it. It's also like asymmetrical. So I think you have a really good example to give us of this sort of process, and then I'll explain kind of the idea behind it.
Yeah, like one thing that they, one particular instance is when they took Malik. Malik is the chief of Kinda. And Kinda is this tribe
in the Nejd today, right?
Yeah, okay. in central Saudi Arabia. And Kinda is this tribe that kind of formed a kingdom called Kinda. That was it was supported by the Yemenis, by the Himyarites.
Okay,
because the Himyarites kind of needed this satellite state in order to reign over the Arabs, to bring order over the Arabs, because the Arabs are just nomads, they're just nomadic, and they don't have a ruler, and they're just raiding here, raiding there, just, they're kind of hard to control, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, so in this particular example, the Yemenis, they took Malik as hostage in exchange for the mischievous Imr'ul Qais, okay, who's another fugitive. And what they did is that, you know, they took him in, and they just try to extort him to bring in Imr al Qais, because I think apparently he killed one of the Himyarid, he killed a relative of the Himyarid king.
Okay.
Imr al Qais.
Okay.
During a raid, and so they had to.
Oh, so they kidnapped him.
Yeah, so they kidnapped Malik in order
Who's the son of? Or who's okay? What's the relationship between Imr al Qais and Malik?
Malik is the chief of Kinda, And Imra al-Qais is, I believe he is his son.
Okay, so they kidnap his dad.
Yeah,
in order to...
yeah, like, where's your son? You know, he can't go away running around like this kid.
Oh, okay, so that's what's going on. So the prince is essentially conducting raids.
Yeah.
And his father gets kidnapped. Okay.
You know, but in some cases, like, the Yemenis kind of had good relations with the Arab, like diplomatic relations, especially with the tribe of Asad, Kinda, and Midhij. But in most cases, there was, like, it's military campaigns against the Arabs, right?
Okay.
And that's why they installed Kinda. It was kind of as a buffer.
And this is where, like, this is around the 500s AD, or like a CE, as we should say, yeah.
Around the 400s, 500s. And, you know, at this point, when they installed that kingdom, Kinda, that Arabian kingdom, in order to rein in on the nomadic tribes and like try and install order over there.
Okay.
The Byzantines, they began to woo the clan of Hujr.
So they're propping their head into the region. So like the Yemenis sort of getting a handle on things, and now the Byzantines, who are like what we think of as the Eastern Christian Romans. Like, the Romans evolve into the Byzantines.
Yeah.
And they kind of, like, rear their head further south again.
And they just so they can get a little bit of, just a little bit of foothold in the region as well, right?
Exactly.
And so there's this account, actually. It says, at this point, the Byzantines began to woo the clan of Hujr, as is recounted by a certain Nonosus, who belonged to a Byzantine diplomatic dynasty. So he tells us that his grandfather has been sent to Harith, son of Amr, son of Hujr al-Kindi, by the Emperor Anastasius. And both his father Abraham and himself were sent to Qais, a descendant of Harith in the time of Justinian. So the gist of it, this guy's talking about how his ancestors were sent as diplomats to Arab tribes.
Exactly.
And so he was talking about who these people are, right?
And there was multiple missions in the times of different emperors, Anastasius and Justinian. And Justinian's the really famous one that like history nerds will know about.
And that was in order to reason with the Arabs, to try to...
to get them on Rome's side.
Exactly, because, you know, whatever caravan was passing by the desert, you know damn well these Arabs are going to be raiding it, you know. And so anyways, so Qais, to whom Nonosus was sent, commanded two of the most notable Arab tribes, Kinda and Ma'ad, before Nonosus appointed his father Abraham, had also been on Justinian's orders to this Qais, and had made a peace treaty, under the terms of which he took Qais's son Muawiyah as hostage and carried him off to Byzantium. So the way they dealt with the Arabs is by taking Qais's son Muawiyah as hostage.
Exactly, but like I'm sort of like gonna explain the idea behind this, because this is not at all uncommon or necessarily that like negative a thing. So like I know it sounds bad, the hostage thing, but like there's exactly two ways you make an alliance in the ancient world, or like you make sure your alliance is kept. And every alliance has to be kept this way. You can either have an alliance of equals where, like, well, there's actually two ways of doing an alliance of equals. There's one where you just have a marriage. Okay. Like, the emperor has a sister or a daughter and marries her off, or you have a daughter and you marry them. You know, it's an equal relationship. That's kind of like the idea of it. Another way of having an equal but not friendly relationship would be to, like, exchange hostages, where you send us somebody, we'll send you another guy, you know, that sort of thing. Although that's much more of a tense kind of relationship to have.
It's kind of coercion.
It's not necessarily coercion, but it's more like definitely a lack of trust. One is essentially, and the last one, the one being described here, is the relationship of a powerful people, them being the Romans and the city of Constantinople. That is a relationship of a master and a subservient. And the Arabs are in the position of the subservient. So they have to send their hostages. But the hostage is like the prince of whichever tribe. he will be educated along with the children of the emperor in the best and given the best food, the best fighting instruction, the best education, all of it. He's going to learn all of the languages of Rome. He's going to learn Greek and Latin, and he's going to come back essentially with a little bit of a better appreciation of the Romans and maybe a good relationship with the next emperor. That's kind of the idea of this. And they did this with everybody. They did it with the Slavs. They did it with the Turks. They did it with everyone they were making alliances with. And it, for the most part, went well.
They worked?
It usually worked. I'm actually going to give like a really... this is a little bit off script, but this is a really good example of when it didn't work. I think his name was Arminius.
Okay.
So that's a Roman name, by the way. We don't know. I'm not sure what his German name was, but in the time of Augustus, the emperor that we were talking about earlier, they had sort of had a bunch of German chiefs send their sons over to Rome to be educated, and often they would serve in the Roman army. One of these guys, Arminius, didn't really take his education well. His brother did. His brother was like all pro-Roman and the rest of it, but Arminius, he wanted to build out like an alliance of Germans, and he led a Roman army into a boggy forest, into a trap that he created of German tribes, and this is the Battle of the Teutoburg Forest. They had no idea. They had basically, he had like pretended there was like this little insurrection over here that the Roman general was going to like go and march through, and he like instructed them to the forest, and he gathered all of the German allies he could and fucked up the Roman army and killed basically everyone. And wow. That's like the worst example of this process. But most of the time, and including with that guy's brother, it actually worked, where the Roman, the hostages would become kind of half Roman and they'd be kind of sympathetic.
But by hostages, I mean, they're not just locked up in a cell or
anything. No. They're given the best education. They're given all of the best, military training even.
So they become part of the court.
They become part of the court, and then they go back at some point when the contract is over or whatever, and they become basically good little allies on the fringes, either as, like, provincial governors or as, like, allied kings. That's kind of the idea.
Yeah, I mean, interesting, really. I didn't think that would actually happen, really, that this is a way of negotiating with somebody to be your friend. Like, let me just kidnap your kid, right? Then you'll be my friend. You know, that's not a way that I envisioned it to happen. But that's what happened with Qais, right?
Exactly. So, like, go ahead and read the rest of this. It's amazing.
Well, he said, well, the rest of it is when Abraham came on another legation to Qais, the latter went to Byzantium, dividing his own command between his brothers Amr and Yazid, while he personally received from the emperor command of Palestine.
He became the governor of Palestine. So this hostage became like a governor for the Roman emperor.
Which goes back to what you were saying, that they're not actually, you know, they're not in jail cells or anything.
But it is like coercive by like modern standards, you know.
It is, yeah.
I guess the modern equivalent is all these petty dictators sending their children off to Oxford to be educated or something. Kind of like the closest thing we have today.
A little bit, yeah.
Like Assad in Syria, he was like a doctor in the UK at some point, and like that didn't, or maybe it did work, who knows. But regardless.
I mean, look, it's better than the Bedouin life, maybe. Bedouin life is... It's amazing, guys. You're going to learn about it more in the couple episodes.
It's not comfortable. Let's not say it's comfortable.
It's not comfortable.
They probably had a more comfortable life in Constantinople, but...
Yeah, but it made them men. Let's just put it that way.
Oban has some old-style ideas. Okay, so...
Anyways, but the Arabs, yeah. The Yemenis did have a contentious relationship with the Arabs. Actually, there was one incident... It's with a man called Abraha al-Habashi, or Abraha the Ethiopian.
Okay.
Now, Abraha was the king of Himyar. However, he is Abyssinian of origin. Mm-hmm. How did that come about? Well, after Himyar... Himyar, by the way, guys, used to be a Jewish kingdom. Okay?
Which we'll get to in another episode. Yeah.
But just briefly speaking, Himyar kind of persecuted the Christians. and because of political reasons, it wasn't really religiously motivated.
Were the Christians the Arabs or the
other? The Christians in the in Yemen.
In Yemen, but yeah. were they the Arabs or the South Arabians?
They were South Arabians.
Okay, okay.
No, they were South Arabians.
All right, all right.
And Aksum, or Ethiopia, if you want, was a Christian kingdom, and they kind of had to step in to intervene. They defeated Himyar, the Himyar, and they installed a Christian king, or an Abyssinian king, if you want, right?
Okay.
And this was Abraha. He was the general who was actually, he's the general who was in charge of the attack against Himyar and who defeated Himyar and then was placed as king of Himyar.
I think I remember, this is actually referenced in the Quran, right?
It is referenced in the Quran because here's what he did. Abraha went beyond what any Yemeni king did when it came to the Arabs. Because whenever the Yemeni kings and the Himyarid, mostly the Himyarid kings, went to war against the Arabs, they didn't go that far, right? They kind of wander. It was mostly within the borders of Yemen. But this guy actually went to Central Arabia, all the way to Central Arabia and to Hijaz, to the tip point of Hijaz, and did like attacks over there, right? And in one of his expeditions, in Islamic traditions, and it's mentioned in the Quran, it's called the expedition of the elephant, where he basically sent in elephants, an army of elephants, himself included, towards Mecca to destroy the Kaaba. And the reason why he wanted to destroy the Kaaba specifically was because he wanted to he was a devout Christian, and he wanted to create a Christian pilgrim center.
So a puppet state there that would be like a Christian site. He wanted to claim it for Christ.
No, not even. He wanted to build a Christian pilgrim center in his own kingdom in Himyar. But the problem was he couldn't get the numbers in.
Wanted to destroy the competition.
So he wanted to destroy the competition because at that time, this is before Islam, by the way. People were still going to the Kaaba for pilgrimage.
I think it's mentioned that Muhammad was born the year of the elephant.
Yeah, he was born on the year of that invasion.
So 570 is when this invasion happened by Islamic tradition.
And that's exactly when Muhammad was Muhammad peace be upon him was born, and that's really why he wanted to destroy the Kaaba. It's really just to destroy the competition and create this pilgrim center.
So to just recap real quick here.
Yeah.
We got a Christian black king overthrowing an Arab-ish Jewish king in Yemen and using elephants to go destroy a pagan Kaaba.
Yeah. In order to
build a Christian empire in Arabia.
A little bit, yeah.
So this is the crazy story that we're getting into now.
And one thing about his invasion is that it was a failed invasion.
Right.
And the Quran actually mentions this about it. The Quran says, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It says, "Have you not considered how your Lord dealt with the people of the elephant? Did he not make their plan go wrong? He sent against them swarms of birds, throwing at them rocks of baked clay, leaving them like chewed up leaves." Sadaq Allah al-Azim. And so this really talks about how his invasion, you know, it was a failed invasion of Mecca, you know, and he just got thrown off by birds, by birds throwing rocks and burnt clay at them, and just completely tearing up his army.
All right, but like just briefly, did he consider it necessary to take over Yemen? Like, what was his justification for that?
Well, it was mainly to save the Christians, I guess, because at that time, Himyar or Yemen was Jewish,
right?
Okay, and they were allied with the Persians.
Okay,
the Byzantines were building churches in Himyarid territory for their merchants, for Byzantine merchants.
Because a lot of the Arabs were converting to Christianity at the time.
Yeah, well, not the Himyarites. Not yet, not
but
yet.
But some of the tribes were.
Some of the tribes were, but not yet. It was mostly just for the Roman merchants whenever they would go from...
But the Nabataeans at this time were Christian. So the northerners who were coming south were Christian.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so they, you know, they built churches over there. The Himyarid king didn't like that because the way he saw it as Rome kind of meddling into Himyarid affairs.
Mm.
He didn't like that at all. So what he would do is that whenever he would he would take Roman caravans and just completely kill the merchants. You know, send them back to completely kill them in order to send a message to Rome, like, "Hey,
stay out of our territory."
Problem was, these Roman merchants used to also do trade with Aksum, and because they were being killed in Yemen, they didn't want to go to Aksum anymore because Aksum was kind of in the way.
And so that king, what was his name again? The
name of the king is Ella Abasha.
The king of the Ethiopians.
Yeah, well, he wasn't the king. He was the general who was sent to...
Oh, okay.
He was a general.
So anyways, the Ethiopians take over to protect the Christians and defeat this kingdom.
And then...
But then the Persians get they get involved too.
The Persians get involved, but actually, no, it's the Romans who get involved.
Okay.
The Romans get involved, but that doesn't really work out because what the Romans wanted was that they kind of wanted the Ethiopians to
bow down to them?
A little bit, really. Not really. It was mostly they wanted the Ethiopians and the Yemenis to go invade the Persians.
Okay.
You know what I mean? They wanted the Ethiopians to sell products, to sell silk
to Rome,
so that they can fund the war that was going to happen between Yemen, the Arabs on one side, and the Persians.
Okay.
You know what I mean? But that didn't really end up working because the Yemenis were kind of scared to go into Arabian territory because the Arabs were kind of more warlike than them. They would just get raided relentlessly against the Arabs. And so, yeah, I mean, that's kind of the history of Yemen, really. And so Yemen remained a Jewish kingdom.
With some Christian
in it.
And like with three empires kind of like fighting over it. There was like Ethiopia, Rome, and then the Persians.
Yeah, and they were speaking, you know, Southern Arabian language, until Islam. And that's when the Prophet Muhammad came to the people of Yemen, preaching Islam to them, and they accepted Islam. Actually, they were the only people to accept Islam without putting up a fight.
Right.
The Arabs are putting up a lot of fight against them. Okay. I mean, if you look at the Prophet Muhammad, he was being persecuted by the tribe of Quraysh, and he participated in many wars against other Arabic tribes because they wouldn't accept because.
You know. Is it because like the Arabs sort of with Islam they sort of liberated the Yemenis from Persian and Ethiopian invaders? Is that why
the Yemenis accepted?
Yeah.
Honestly, I don't know. I wouldn't know.
I think we're gonna research this a little bit more.
That's something that I don't know. In fact, the Prophet Muhammad loved them so much he called them the beloved ones.
The beloved ones.
Right. He called them the beloved ones, and he even has this thing. He even has this this quote where he says, "Belief is Yemenite and wisdom is Yemenite, while pride and haughtiness are the qualities of the owners of camels, i.e. the Bedouins. Calmness and solemnity are the characters of the owners of sheep." So he was talking very highly of the Yemenis, but he doesn't talk highly at all of the Arabs. You know?
His own people.
No, not at all. And that's Yemen, actually, man. It's this wonderful place. It's the birth, it's kind of the birthplace of the Arabs as a people, but not as a culture nor as a language.
I guess
you know what I mean?
I guess this gets back to like this sort of like loose understanding of identity, because like, what is a Mexican person today? The word Mexican is from Mexica, which means like the Aztecs who lived there before. And like their culture and a lot of their culture and some of their ancestry is of those people, but a lot of it was supplanted by another culture, but they still identify with that earlier culture. And maybe that's what we're talking about when we're talking about...
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, no, it's exactly that. It's exactly that. It's where basically the Arabs kind of... They look at Yemen as maybe their place of origin. And even then, I don't even think that's true, because they were raiding the crap out of the Yemenis. But they were actually at war with them.
But here's the thing. When you're in such close contact with people, with raiding and trading... And, like, crucially, like, we didn't really mention this that much, but the Ma'rib Dam that we were discussing that was so crucial to such a big part of Yemen, it burst several times in a couple hundred years. And the last time it burst was right as everything was coming crashing down for the Himyarite kingdom and all these invaders were coming in. And that pushed a lot of these people to move north into Arab territory and sort of become adopted by local tribes or form local confederations with them. So it's sort of like, even before Muhammad and the conversion, there's sort of like this coming together of the cultures. And that can happen even with raids and trade and all the rest of it. When you're in such close contact with people, eventually...
No, you're right. Because also this one thing, mind you, the Yemenis had, other than Ethiopia, the Arabs were the only cultural contact that they actually had, right?
Right.
Because they live on the borders of Arabia, and so I mean, there's a lot of exchange there, but Arabness isn't from Yemen.
I know, but
Arab culture, Bedouin culture, is not from Yemen. That's with the Nabataeans, and the
next episode.
Yeah, and the Nabataeans and the Aramaic people.
Exactly.
That's where Arabic culture and language and identity comes from.
It is influenced by that, but I guess what you could say the Yemenis are kind of the first Arabized people.
Yeah.
And they had one of the biggest and deepest impacts on Arab culture that doesn't really get talked about today.
Exactly.
And even among Arabs, like they don't spare much thought for Yemen all that often.
No, they don't. I mean, they're going to war against Yemen, right?
Oh, Saudis, but... We don't have time for that necessarily. No,
but it's it goes back to what we said on the first episode about, you know, the Qahtani Arabs are seen as the original Arabs, and those are the Yemenis, the Southern Arabians, right? The Yemenis.
So this culture that may seem foreign to the Arabs really has like a very sacred place in like the history.
Yes, it does. I mean, it's to the point where the Prophet kind of praises them.
Exactly.
Right?
All right.
And yeah, folks, this is Yemen for you guys. This is one of the best, actually one of the most beautiful places in the world. Not much talked about, but it has significant impact and influence on the Arab culture and on Arabs. And this is what we're talking about. This is the whole point of this podcast, is really to bring light to, you know, the Arab culture.
Exactly. And we'll leave you off on that note with a little tune from the Yemeni people of today. And we hope you'll enjoy.
Take care, guys.
Have a great evening. Bye.
ولقد أسد من أسود الله من ساهب الشعار
يماني يماني هيبة هالاسم ولقد أسد من أسود الله من ساهب الشعار
يومي لبين دا الوجد ويفزع مع الصحب
يمر مع تراه الخوف ينتم محل كلام
تنابي على العصواب جناها ذهب حزام الطرف ما يحسبه للقى حساب رجاج هيلتك دحنا رلا تهورت وشب جوارح لهم مخلب ضواري لهم نياب
يا ماني يا ماني ويفزع مع الصحب دمر مع تراه الخوفي يمتين بحل كلاب
فقور اليمن في الجو قناصة العقب ومن يفهم العنوان فيعرف الجواب بهم يرتكي ظهري ما تشتدت الكرب وفيهم عصب الراس في السهلم والحرب سلامي عليهم السماء رعدها ضرب وما يلمي البارق وما شنت السحاب تحية زكية أهل اليمن موطن العرب وقبل أهل شايبها وقبل أهل كل شالي الفخر يوم امدح صبوري ولا عجب وشعري على الفطرة وشعر الملاك تزال رجال المواقف نارهم تاكل الحطب ولا الوجه قد سود ولا بان قط
ليوت البراري تسعفك ساعة الطلب وعول الخلا عدتها تنطح الرجال
رمات المقفت وقت ما دم للركب ما تثورت كانوا على المعتدي عذاب بدرب الكرامة لا فتي تتبع السبب لنيل المطالب قومي تستسهل الصعاب ومن كان مثلي للتبابع قد انتسب له الحق يا بولادي افخر بالانتساب
متى غاب عن ربعي شنب يخلفه شنب حضوره اذا شرف يكفي عن الغياب
جهادي مقومي فرع من خيرة العرب وفي الطرف تعدي وتبدي كما ثياب لهم صبب وشبح متى حنت القبب لهم يحجر الفتان
يا ماني يا ماني هيدا